This is the Victoria Spring Study Day. Our topic for the weekend is the Unexpected Sermon on the Mount. We have with us our brother Mark Hunter speaking from the Saanich Peninsula Ecclesia, and this is his second class entitled Be Perfect.
Thanks again, Brother Chase. So where did we come from? We came from a different perspective on religion, a perspective more based on character attributes and their manifestation than necessarily a set of hard and fast rules. And yet, paradoxically, Jesus is reinforcing the validity and the permanence and the value of the law. And he talks about washing feet. You know, you can have the blessing if you know and if you do the things that Jesus is commanding. And then we came to this absolutely staggering statement. This is one of these unexpected moments, and we really need to get into the minds of the culture of the day. You've got to be better than the best, or you're not in God's kingdom. Better than the people who your entire society understands to be the pinnacle of religion. And if you're not better than them, you're out. Now, how is a fisherman or a shoemaker who scrounges a living and sees these Pharisees go by who can spend hours a day on study of scripture, how can they possibly live up to that? How can I be more righteous than the Pharisees? Now, throughout the rest of this chapter, Jesus is going to make a technical argument, and there's a lot of exhortational content. And so we're going to be jumping back and forth between Jesus' technical argument and his exhortational content. So I hope you'll bear with me. So there's seven sections in the rest of this chapter, and we'll begin with the first one. Thou shalt not kill. We just read it, verses 21 to 26. It is not coincidental that Jesus is quoting one of the Ten Commandments. Okay, it's not coincidental that he's quoting one which is relatively easy to achieve for most people. Right? Now, but when he describes it, he goes and he extends it. Okay, so we push the legalists aside for a moment, and then we bring it back, and then we say, you know, those onerous rules which the legalists have imposed upon you, that's nothing. What you really need is to go far beyond what they've placed on you. And this is, you know, I remember in my early days in the truth, what I considered to be the pinnacle of life in the truth. And then when I look at these passages, and it's like, get along with people, right? Verses 21 to 26, just get along with people. Can you do that? Can you actually do that? Like, not think mean thoughts about other people? That's the pinnacle. Leave your gifts upon the altar. Okay, if you're coming to the ecclesia and you're serving the ecclesia and you think that serving the ecclesia has a higher priority than resolving a conflict with your brother, you've got it all wrong, Jesus is saying. Stop serving the ecclesia. Start serving your brother. Money, that doesn't matter. You know those other duties you have, those important tasks? A sideshow. Drop it. Like, the moment you realize your brother has something against you, you stop the other stuff you're doing because that's not more important to God. Whatever it is you might be doing, not more important to God. The most important thing for God is you sort out that conflict first. And it's interesting, if you remember that your brother has something against you, right? It's not even that you're upset with him, it's he's upset with you. Well, isn't that his problem? He's the one who's upset, right? Shouldn't he be leaving his gift at the altar and coming over here and sorting things out? No, Jesus says it's your problem. Even though he's upset, your problem, your top priority is to do something about it. You shall not commit adultery. Again, most people find this law as it stands in the Ten Commandments not that hard to follow. It's probably a little harder to follow than not killing, absolutely. But most people can pull this one off until Jesus redefines it, right? And he says, no, if you've lusted, you're committing adultery. He takes a rule that is arguably easy to uphold into one that is absolutely impossible to attain. And he says, pluck out your eye. Okay, read this for the first time. He's saying, oh, you have a problem with, you know, looking at things that you shouldn't look at? You know what the solution to that is? You gouge out your eyeball and you throw it away. Like, can you imagine you're sitting there listening to Jesus, the gentle teacher? He's like, yeah, the solution to this, gouge out your own eyeballs. Chop off your own hands. Why? Because this is serious. This is life and death. If you're trivializing this stuff, you're making a huge mistake. Now, I don't see anybody in here missing eyeballs or missing hands. So nobody seems to be taking this entirely literally, myself included. But if we're not going to take it literally, can we at least absorb the urgency of what Jesus is saying? Can we respect him by taking him seriously? He's not making a joke here. He's saying there's stuff in your life that leads to lust, and you got to cut that out, even though it hurts. It's going to disrupt your life. But the right choice is to cut that stuff out. You know, if you're on a diet, you don't put a tray of these in your house. Right? Now, when you're on a diet, you have good times and you have bad times. You have times where you're strong and you have times when you're not strong. And there's a little bit of a paradox, because when you're strong, you look at the donuts and say, donuts aren't a problem for me. Yes, I'm a diet. I just won't eat one. And so you don't prepare for that time that's going to come when you're not strong. And that time is going to come when you're not strong, and there are going to be the donuts, and everything goes downhill from there. Right? So the trick for us is that when we are strong and when we are confident, we need to remake our environment to make it safer for ourselves. And that probably involves cutting some stuff out of your life. Cutting some stuff that you can't handle on a bad day. So when it's a good day, cut it off. And then when it's a bad day, it won't be there. So, too many exhortations out of 7 from Jesus. There's some commonality between them. Cause and effect, right? People don't just wake up and kill somebody. People don't just wake up and go commit adultery. There is a long series of precursor situations that lead to these disasters. And so our job is to not just focus on that last domino and say, oh, I couldn't help myself. Well, maybe you couldn't by the time it got here, but maybe if you'd have done something back here up the chain, maybe we could have stopped this tragedy. Right? Jesus is saying, you got to go up the chain. And it goes back to anger, and it goes back to lust. There's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Daniel Kahneman. He's a Jewish fellow. He wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. And he's analyzing thinking from an economic perspective. But there's an interesting crossover, because he deals with the problems of anger and lust. And when he says thinking fast and slow, he's saying your brain operates in two quite different ways depending on the situation. And one of the things they noticed is that when people are in the grip of anger or in the grip of lust, they behave totally differently than they do other times. And you can have them fill out questionnaires. So if we take all of you here, assuming none of you are enraged at the moment, right? And you filled out what kind of actions you felt were reasonable under the circumstances. And then we gave you a questionnaire when you were enraged, you get a totally different set of answers. And so while they study this and they say, and the same is true for lust. Okay, there's all kinds of behaviors that you would in this room right now say, well, that's totally unacceptable and inappropriate. And yet if you're in a different situation, all of a sudden that becomes a plausible option. And so they tried to study this. They said, well, how do we help people in the grip of rage or in the grip of lust make the wiser choice? Because the choices we make in those states, by the way, are not good choices. How do we help people in those states make better choices? And you know what they discovered? You can't. Like, your brain has reverted to an animal state that just doesn't understand logic anymore. And you can explain and you can train and you can, there's, and then you take all these people who've gone through these courses and understood all this material and you put them in that enraged or lustful situation and it all goes out the window. It makes no difference in outcome. It's horrifying. And so his only advice, coincidentally, is Jesus' advice, which is don't get in those situations in the first place, right? Go up the chain, right? Don't be in situations where you will be so angry. Don't be in situations where lust is going to be a factor, because once you're there, it's almost always just too late. How great a forest, says James, is set ablaze by a small flame. So, proper relationships are crucial. Slippery slopes are real. Our words matter. And Jesus makes a call for drastic action. We should respect Jesus by seriously considering whether our lives need drastic action. Well, let's go back to our technical argument, which is, how can I be more righteous than a Pharisee? And we see this unfolding in the structure of Jesus' arguments. You have heard, but I say to you, right? What is our definition of righteousness? You've heard one definition of righteousness, and I'm going to give you another definition of righteousness. And not coincidentally, he begins with two of the Ten Commandments. And what he says is, you need to go beyond the limit. Okay, where the law has painted a double yellow line saying you shall not cross, don't stand at the very edge of that line and say, I haven't killed anybody, I haven't killed anybody, I haven't killed anybody, right? That wasn't the point of the law. Okay, that line of not killing was meant for you to understand the absolute minimum level, and you're supposed to spend your life trying to move in the opposite direction. Do you ever notice in the Olympics, you know, when people are racing and then they cross the line, what do? Collapse. Do they? Well, they stop. They slow down and stop. The moment they cross the line, I did all this work. Now I crossed a little piece of paint in the ground and then they stop. And we can do the same thing with God's commandments, right? Oh, you know, now I didn't kill anybody. I'm done. Checked it off my list, right? I'm a good person today. No dead bodies, right? But the other common thing in here is universal condemnation. This is pretty scary. Everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable. Have you ever been angry? You are Cain. Everybody who looks at a woman with lust has committed adultery. Have you ever looked at a woman with lust? Or a man, depending on your gender? You are David. Right? We're so judgmental against Cain and David. And what Jesus is saying is that you are Cain and you are David. So what is Jesus' point? It's a bit of a scary point, which is if we think that because we've kept the law that we're righteous, then we're wrong. Keeping the law does not necessarily mean we're righteous. You can keep the law and be unrighteous. Basically, Jesus is saying sin isn't binary. In other words, it's not just zeros and ones. It's not just, yep, I sinned, no, I didn't sin, no, I didn't sin, yep, sinned, no, didn't sin. It doesn't work that way. It's not an all or nothing proposition. Sin is analog. We start in absolute darkness, and then we move our way to absolute light. But all along the way, there's 1,000 different variations of where we might be on 1,000 different scriptural principles. Okay? It's not like, oh, I didn't kill anybody, so I'm up here. No, it doesn't work that way. It's a question of degrees. It's not a question of black and white. So, and we brought in the legalists, and now we're crushing them by making their burden harder, and we brought in the anti-legalists, but now we're crushing them because they didn't even want to do what the legalists wanted to do, and now Jesus is asking them to do more. Well, we have to pause for a minute and consider whether Jesus is establishing a new law. Okay? Because it said, you know, thou shalt not kill, and now Jesus is saying, well, thou shalt not be angry. So is it just a matter of moving the line? You know, there was the thou shalt not kill line, and now Jesus is saying, no, actually the right line is this other line of thou shalt not be angry. And if we take that view, it presents a few problems. One of them is a problem in the law itself. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, 32, it says, everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to it or take from it. Now, Jesus already established that he wasn't taking anything away from the law, but is he adding to it? Because if he is, he's breaking it. And we know that can't be true. So what exactly is going on here? The law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. Why was the law of Moses the law of sin and death? You know, was the problem with the law of Moses simply that it was the wrong laws? Did these tablets come out with the wrong words on them? Right? If these tablets had shown up with thou shalt not be angry, would it have been all okay then? The right recipe, but the wrong ingredients? Romans 8 says, what the law could not do, weak as it was, through the flesh. So it turns out that the problem with the law isn't so much the law, it's the flesh, right? And we still have the flesh. It's still here. Galatians 3:21, is the law against the promises of God? Certainly not. If there had been a law given which was able to impart life, truly righteousness would have been by the law. If there was a series of words that could be put down on some tablets of stone that could have saved you, then those words would have come down from Mount Sinai. If it could have been done, it would have been done. Galatians chapter 3 deals with this topic extensively. Maybe we can look it up. Galatians chapter 3 and read verses 11 and 12. That no one is justified by the law before God is evident. For the righteous man, remember, that's what we're trying to define. We're trying to define what it means to be righteous. The righteous man shall live by faith. However, the law is not of faith. On the contrary, he who practices them shall live by them. Now, it doesn't say the righteous man shall live by a different set of laws. Do you understand what's going on here? Like, there's a list of rules, and there's a problem with the list of rules, but Galatians is making clear that the solution to that list of rules isn't a different set of rules. It's not just a substitutionary thing. It isn't a longer list of rules. The solution is faith. It's a totally different approach to the problem. For Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. It doesn't say Abraham followed a different set of rules and that's what was counted to him as righteousness. It was his belief. It was his faith that was the source of righteousness. Romans 10. And again, the whole beginning of Romans 10 is a study on this topic. We won't go through it all, but for not knowing about God's righteousness, this is the Jews, and seeking to establish their own. This is one of the problems with rules-based religion, is we tend to tailor the rules to suit our personalities. And then we follow those rules. See, we draw a box, and then we play within the box, and we say, look, we're pretty good. Right? You guys outside the box, not so much. But here in this box, right? And how do we become so comfortable in that box? Well, we bend the edges of it to suit our personalities. Not knowing about God's righteousness and seeking to establish their own, they did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. Comes back to faith again. Not to everyone who follows a different set of rules. Not to everyone who follows a longer set of rules. To everyone who believes. So, Christ is giving us a series of instructions and commandments even, but we have to be very careful that we don't just recreate the Mosaic system of religion with a different set of words. We have to understand that Christ's commandments are of a different nature than the commandments of the law of Moses. They should not be treated in the same way. Brings us to the next section. Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and 32. It was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So, let's make sure we look at these verses in this context. What is the context? The context is, I didn't kill anybody. I followed the law, therefore I am righteous. And so Jesus is saying, if you use divorce in this same way, you are unrighteous. What's an example? Well, if I'm married to my wife, but I want to be with another woman, and I just go do that, then I'm an adulterer. I'm outside the confines of the law. I am an unrighteous person. Everybody agrees about that. But if I take this piece of paper, sign here, and I take a different piece of paper and sign there, I can do the exact same thing and be totally righteous human being. Right? That's following the law. All I'm doing is following the law. Right? You can marry, you can divorce in the law of Moses. It's not against the law. It's following the rules. And Jesus is saying, if you're following the rules, but your intent is evil, then you're still evil. It doesn't matter that you followed all the rules. Okay, so that's the point Jesus is making here. Now, well, let's see. There's something curious about this one versus all the other ones in this chapter. How many of you think you can go through life without being angry? Okay. How many of you think you can go through life without ever having a lustful thought? Note takers. How many of you think you can go through life without getting divorced? Oh, come on, chickens. All right. Okay, and any of you who didn't see your spouse raise their hand, you might want to check for some ecclesial counseling budget or something there, but isn't that odd? And if we go through the whole rest of the chapter, every other one of the things in here, we would all assume are impossible. And yet this one seems fairly reasonable, right? I don't anticipate getting divorced, so I'll sign off on that, right? But if we read other passages about the culture at the time, there's another section on divorce in Matthew chapter 19, where Jesus explains to his disciples, you know, divorce isn't actually how you should approach life. And they're horrified. They're like, you can't be serious. What do you mean we shouldn't divorce? Like, if I can't get divorced, I'm not getting married. If such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry. These are the disciples saying this, okay? These aren't scallywags out there. These are the disciples. And in their culture, divorce was the foundation of marriage. The only reason I'm willing to make a commitment with you is because I can break it with a signature whenever I feel like it. The law allows it, and if I do that, I'm righteous, by the way. Right? That was that approach to religion. That was the approach to righteousness that Jesus is attacking in this section. You can't just have an evil intent and make sure that you get all the right paperwork done, and all of a sudden you're still a good person and you got away with it. Now, I do think we need to beware of treating this two verses in Matthew different than all the other verses in this chapter. Sometimes we make a bit of an exception in our community between people who fail in the first section and people who fail on the second section and people who fail on the third section. I think we should be cautious about that. So we've covered three topics. The fourth, you shall not swear falsely. So does our yes mean yes? Does our no mean no? This is a curious one because it's not one we tend to worry about a whole lot in our modern culture. It's almost like we've kind of given up on holding people accountable to their word, and we just assume that yes may or may not mean yes and no may or may not mean no. It's interesting, this is in the context of marriage, right? That was what we were just talking about, two verses up. When you said you were going to stick with her forever, did that yes actually mean yes? Or was it yes if? Right? Yes, maybe, or as long as. Now, do we have subject twos? Hidden subject twos in our commitment? When we get baptized, are we saying, yes, I'm going to commit to this as long as, you know, the fine print, as long as people treat me nicely in this community and as long as I have good health and I don't deal with certain kinds of illnesses and as long as I have opportunity to, what's our list? Do you have one? Short answer is yes. We all have these lists, right? We've made the commitment, but we expect certain conditions to be met. And our lifelong goal is to basically eliminate things from this list. I'll stick with my wife as long as she treats me this way. Really? That's not yes meaning yes. Now, why is this a problem. Well, you know, there's marriage and there's baptism. These are really big commitments. But Jesus doesn't talk about this only in the context of big commitments. He says your yes should be yes all the time. And we struggle with that. And I want to give you an analogy here that might help, at least to help me think about it. If I sell pizzas and you buy a pizza from me, I need to deliver a pizza to you in order for this to be a fair exchange. You paid me for a pizza, I give you a pizza. Okay? Now imagine if my pizza business has subject twos. So you come and you pay me for a pizza, but sometimes you get half a pizza because I ran out of pepperoni. Or half the time you don't get a pizza at all. Now, how would your pizza business fare if you ran it this way? Well, you may be able to still make a go of it, but people aren't going to pay you as much for your pizza, right? How much are you going to pay at a pizza shop if there's a chance you're only going to get half a pizza?
Absolutely nothing, because it wouldn't be fair.
That wouldn't be fair. I know. Thank you, Tabitha. But we do this in our commitments to each other, right? Can you help me out this weekend doing such and such? Yeah, sure, we say. And socially, we get our full pizza payment, right? We have all our pizza money. And then the weekend comes along, and you know what? I'm just feeling kind of tired today. It was a rough Friday, so I'm just not going to be able to make it. Send a text. Sorry, can't make it. Ah, we got our pizza money, right? We got all the social value of being agreeable and helpful, but when it came time to deliver the pizza, didn't show up. Okay? We do this with habitual lateness as well. Meet you at 12 o'clock. Okay? If you show up at 12:15, well, we didn't meet me at 12 o'clock, and now you got 15 more minutes of life than they did. So you got a little bit of extra payment. They're not getting what they're entitled to. So this also comes up in parenting. Parents, it's okay to say no to your children. They won't explode. True story. You'll observe this in parenting, and I've observed this firsthand, that children are actually very clever at knowing whether yes means yes or no means no. And we're the ones who are a little bit dumb about it. So the kid says, you know, can I stay up late? And we say no. And then they come back and say, no, can I stay up late? And we say no. And then after four times, you keep saying no, no. And on the fifth time, they throw a fit, and they're this, and they're that, and they cry, and they're blah, 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 blah. And then finally, like, okay, yes, stay up late. Right? Now, why does it work? And in fact, the kid knows intuitively that when you said no, what you really meant was you need to ask five times, throw a fit, and then it will be yes. Right? They just, like, they've learned that from interacting with us. They've learned that our yes means not necessarily, and our no means, well, I'll change my mind depending on how much you threaten me. Okay? And so when kids behave this way, we don't blame them. They have clearly understood the rules of the game, and they're playing the game exactly the way you set it up. Right? If your yes really means yes and your no really means no, then your kid's gonna figure it out really quick. All those problems will go away. Just a little side note here. Jesus starts in this section saying, you know, you don't control the heavens, you don't control the earth, you don't control Jerusalem, you don't control your head, you don't control the hairs on your head. So what's the point of Jesus saying all these things that we don't control? Very careful what you commit to, right? Don't start saying yes to stuff when you don't control it. My great uncle Charlie used to be good about this. He would say, all being well. Every time he would agree to something, he would add the words, all being well. I'll help you on the weekend, all being well. We'll see you next year, all being well. See you next Sunday, all being well. And it makes sense. I don't know what's going to happen between this week and next week. You know, I don't want to pretend that I'm making a commitment that I can't hold. Psalm 15. And time is flying, but I find this a little bit staggering. It's just so counter to our current culture. Psalm 15, looking at verse 1 and 4. O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Who may dwell on thy holy hill? Right? Lofty. This is back to what is the definition of righteousness? What does it mean to be righteous? Dwelling in God's tent, dwelling on God's holy hill. Verse 4. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. Right? He who said yes, and when it came time to deliver, it was going to be a horrible problem, and they delivered anyway. Somebody who sticks by their commitments even when it's hard is admirable in God's eyes. And we can say that about meeting you at noon, right? Am I going to stick to that even if it inconveniences me? Generally, we don't. No, I had to get coffee at Timmy's, so line up. Stuff happens. Sorry. Right? No. It's like, how important is it when you commit to something? And then this, of course, applies massively on the scales of marriage and baptism. Right? These big commitments. Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now, at first, this sounds a little savage, but it's actually a very noble principle in context. The point of the law of there being an eye for an eye is to say everybody's eyes are equal. Okay, we have to understand that certain people aren't automatically better than other people. If it's a nobleman's eye or if it's a slave's eye, if it's a man's eye, if it's a woman's eye, if it's the king, if it's a servant, an eye for an eye. Human beings are equal creatures. Right? You can't devalue somebody's body as compared to somebody else's. I don't care what the circumstances are. So this was never implemented in the law of Moses on the basis of actually plucking people's eyes or taking out people's teeth. It was understood in the notion of the value. The value that that eye has to you is equal for everybody. And if you cost somebody their eye, then you need to make it good. Well, what does Jesus say? Well, he says, don't resist the evil one. He says, don't try to make it even. Accept the fact that it's unfair. Accept injustice. There is righteousness in accepting injustice, accepting mistreatment. It's so contrary to everything in human nature and in our society. 1 Peter 3:9, talking about Jesus, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but give a blessing instead. Hey, where have we heard about blessings lately? Give a blessing, for you were called to the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. Now, there's a little bit of a trick going on in that verse. Did anybody see that? In the first half of the verse, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead, who's getting the blessing? Right? That wretched bad guy. Right? The guy who's doing evil, the guy who's insulting you. So there's somebody doing evil at you and insulting you, and you turn around and you give them a blessing instead. Right? Evil person gets blessing. Ah, seems so unfair. For you were called to that very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. Oh, interesting way to turn it around. It turns out we're the rotten ones, and God is blessing us in spite of our rottenness. All he's asking us to do is to treat other people the way God treats us. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. It doesn't actually say hate your enemy in the Bible. They've just taken the logical conclusion of a biblical principle. Oh boy, we gotta be very careful when we take logical conclusions from biblical principles when that logical conclusion is never stated in the Bible. There's a lot of things that we assert as dogma and we do not have a supporting Bible passage for it. To the law and the prophets, if they do not speak according to this, it's because they have no life, it says. No light, sorry. Be very careful about our extrapolations about Scripture. If it's so important, if this principle is so important, then it's going to be in the Bible. And if it's not in the Bible, then it may or may not be true, but it's certainly not important. So, it causes a sound. Okay, we'll just skip ahead that same principle we just talked about. Now, Jesus has just walked us through six different exhortational sections based on commandments in the Old Testament. We have to ask ourselves now, is it just these six? Or is he setting up a pattern? Okay? Does this kind of thinking apply to all the other things that we might find? For instance, tithing. Can we take the same approach to tithing? Don't come up to the line, but try to go beyond it. Our principle of the Sabbath, we were just talking about it in the break. Principle of sacrifice, hospitality, humility, praise, modesty, honesty, generosity, study, service, prayer. It doesn't end with these six. He's laid out six to be a pattern that you can apply to any scriptural principle. Don't try to live by the minimum. Try to push it to the absolute maximum. And then, on the seventh command, Jesus rested. What does it mean to be righteous? And Tabitha was waiting for the official answer to the question. And here it is, Matthew 5:48. You therefore must, don't forget the must, you therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now don't try to redefine perfection on me. That trick, I know what you're thinking. No, you must be perfect in the way defined by God. That is what it means to be righteous. Again, we brought our legalists into the fold, and now we've crushed them under the weight of their own laws. And we brought the anti-legalists into the fold, and we've crushed them by the weight of responsibility. The law, which no one can keep, isn't good enough to get you into the kingdom because the law cannot define righteousness. You just can't put it in words. The law can't encapsulate righteousness. God is the definition of righteousness. And in John 1:14 it says, the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we saw his glory. Glory is the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. For the law was given through Moses, and grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. That's why we have Jesus. You want to see righteousness? Don't go look in a book. Well, yes, look in the book, but see Jesus in the book. It's so simple. So simple, right? It's a simple definition and completely devastating. Completely devastating to any illusions we might have. And why do we care so much about lines? You know, here's a map of Philistine and Israelite territory, and I've erased the line. That's unsettling. Why is it unsettling? Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm Philistine territory or I'm in Israelite territory. Well, why do you want to know exactly where Philistine territory ends and exactly where Israelite territory ends? Well, because I want to walk right along that edge. That's not the point, right? If that's what you're using lines for, to walk along the edge, you've got it all wrong. We tend to think of righteousness this way. Yeah, here's perfection, yeah, and here's evil, and there's this spot. I just need to get over that spot. This is the law of Moses. Or maybe we draw a different law up here. Maybe we have a, you know, whatever. We draw a line somewhere and we say, you know, if I can just get over that line, then I'll be righteous. Jesus says, there's no such line. Righteousness is a simple definition. It's right up here. That's the definition of righteousness. How do you play the game when you know you can't win? Right? Have you ever been in one of those games? Maybe it's a board game, maybe it's a sports game, and you're playing it and all of a sudden you realize that winning is impossible. What do you do? It's really illuminating about your relationship with the game at that point in time. Some people stop playing, right? If I can't win, I'm not going to play. And they walk away. But why would anybody keep playing a game that's impossible to win? Right? The only reason to keep playing a game that's impossible to win is if you actually enjoy playing the game. If you actually believe in playing the game. Right? And you're not as interested in winning. You're more interested in the activities that arise from playing this game. This is the idea that Jesus is forcing you to confront in this chapter. If you're trying to win the game of righteousness, you can't win that game. You're not going to win. So once you've been destroyed that way, once foundations of your righteousness have collapsed, what do you do next? And why do you do it? Are you still willing to try to live these principles? Well, that's fantastic. Why would you do it? Well, you would do it because being better is better than being worse. Right? And so you accept that I'm going to get up this morning and I'm not going to be righteous by the ultimate definition of righteousness. So what am I going to do with my day then? Well, I'm going to move in that direction because I believe in righteousness. And I believe that righteousness is a better destination than any other destination that's out there. You therefore must be perfect, as your Heavenly Father is perfect.